A young boy stands on a soccer field in Texas, his turban marking him as different. The referee approaches, demanding to pat him down, muttering "little terrorist" under his breath. The boy complies, swallowing his rage. Less than a year later, when a teammate rips off his turban and jokes about bombs, that same boy's fist connects with the teammate's nose before anyone can intervene. These weren't isolated incidents. They were defining moments that would shape an entire life's work. What happens when the world sees you as a threat before you've even spoken? There's a peculiar exhaustion that comes from being simultaneously hyper-visible and invisible. Picture walking through an airport where every eye follows you with suspicion, yet when you raise your hand in a meeting, people look right through you. This paradox defines life for many marginalized communities, seen as threats, unseen as humans. Growing up Sikh in Texas meant navigating this double consciousness daily. Family life felt quintessentially American, playing basketball with neighborhood kids, video games after school, backyard football games. Yet public spaces told a different story. Bathrooms became battlegrounds where other boys would push and shove, questioning the right to be there. Sports fans yelled to knock that towel off the point guard's head. Even innocent moments, like preschool dress-up time, became painful when teachers insisted on the princess role because of long hair. The family developed survival strategies. A mother gave presentations at schools about Punjabi culture, essentially pleading, "Please don't fear us." Brothers invented games to cope, showing up at basketball courts pretending to be foreign, then stunning everyone with perfect English and killer crossovers. These weren't just coping mechanisms, they were daily negotiations with a world that couldn't decide whether to fear you or ignore you. Think of it like being a ghost that people only notice when they're scared. You exist in a liminal space between threat and invisibility, never quite allowed to simply be human. This is the reality that transformed personal pain into a philosophy of radical love, one that challenges everything we think we know about responding to hate. September 11, 2001 shattered everything. Watching towers fall in a Texas classroom, dread intensified seeing Osama bin Laden, a brown skin, long beard, white turban. Within hours, the family's door locked for the first time. Death threats flooded in. Hate violence surged, roughly 10 attacks daily against six. Balbir Singh Sodhi became the first post-9/11 hate crime victim, murdered at his Arizona gas station. Yet darkness brought unexpected light. Neighbors delivering food, classmates offering protection, strangers leaving flowers. This moment crystallized a truth. Ignoring hate wasn't enough. At 17, the choice became clear. Remain passive or author your own life. Survival required moving from non-racist to actively anti-racist. Harvard promised refuge. Reality struck at the Boston Marathon when boys threw rocks chanting "Taliban" while parents watched silently. A volunteer refused water service, calling out "filthy Muslim," leaving a runner dehydrated for miles. Another spectator shouted, "Run faster! That guy from ISIS is chasing you!" The crowd laughed. Not one person spoke up. Education doesn't automatically translate to inclusive behavior. Silence became its own violence, complicity dressed as neutrality. Academic work revealed disturbing truths. American racism has deep religious roots. The doctrine of discovery gave European Christian explorers divine authority to claim discovered lands. Christianity was weaponized through selective biblical interpretation to uphold white supremacy, creating systems still affecting how religious minorities are perceived today. We're not just fighting individual bigotry, we're confronting centuries of institutionalized thinking. August 5, 2012. A gunman attacks a Wisconsin Gurdwara. Frantic calls, hours of silence, then relief. Everyone is safe. The deadliest attack on a place of worship in nearly 50 years, yet reporters stumble through descriptions misidentifying the Sikh temple. Within an hour, an editor urged using this platform to speak for the community. Despite years of silence and fear, there was a choice: freeze or act. The resulting essay spread rapidly, leading to interviews and advocacy. But nobody saw the crushing gap between the public message of peace and private feelings of rage. This dissonance created a crisis of authenticity. Finding solid footing would require complete transformation. The journey began with the survivors themselves. The Oak Creek survivors embodied Chardi Kala, everlasting optimism, not toxic positivity, but fierce commitment to finding light in darkness. When asked how they maintained happiness amid trauma, every survivor pointed to gratitude. They appreciated their lives, the safety of loved ones, recognizing things could have been worse. Gratitude is revolutionary because it trains attention. Your mind is a spotlight. Shine it on what's broken or what's whole. Both exist simultaneously. Gratitude means consciously directing that spotlight toward what nourishes. Starting a simple practice, 5 minutes nightly, reflecting on three things to appreciate, created profound transformation. The more you look for blessings, the more apparent they become. Gratitude doesn't change circumstances, it changes you. At a Sikh summer camp, a young girl called the temple shooter a bad, bad man who was evil. Her words struck uncomfortably. They mirrored the internal language used to describe Wade Michael Page. What began as accurate terms like racist and white supremacist had devolved into seeing him as inherently evil, fundamentally other. This betrayed core Sikh belief that divinity exists in everyone. When a boy asked if the killer also contained divine light, a young girl offered profound wisdom. "I think the killer had Vaheguru inside of him, but he chose to ignore God, and so he did a bad thing." This concept of radical connectedness, Ek Onkar, offers a revolutionary framework. Social oppressions like racism aren't inherent but learned, meaning they can be unlearned. This shifts the question from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. On a flight, an older white man sighed heavily upon seeing his turban seatmate, then ignored the greeting. But conversation revealed he was returning from cancer treatment, feeling utterly defeated. Both had stereotyped each other. Their exchange deepened into reflections on life and death, forging unexpected connection. When we dare to see the humanity in those who seem to hate us, we often discover they're carrying unbearable weight. The question becomes, are we willing to create conditions that make transformation possible? When a first daughter arrives, love suddenly feels inadequate to describe the overwhelming feeling that makes you understand your parents' sacrifices. In the early 17th century, Guru Tegh Bahadur demonstrated love's ultimate form when he spoke out for persecuted Kashmiri Brahmins, though neither he nor his Sikh community were targeted. For this solidarity, he was imprisoned, tortured, and executed, revealing love's essence, unconditional, selfless, and ever-giving. Before parenthood, even family relationships were measured through a cost-benefit lens. But parenthood changes everything, staying up all night when she's sick, prioritizing her needs above personal comfort. This extraordinary capacity exists in others too. Heather Heyer dying while opposing white supremacy, Ravi Singh rushing toward crises to help refugees, Malala Yousafzai continuing to advocate after being shot. Love isn't a limited resource reserved for our children. It's an expandable capacity, a muscle we strengthen through practice. The question isn't whether we're capable of this love, it's whether we're willing to expand our circle of compassion until it includes even those who seem unlovable. This kind of love isn't passive sentiment, it's revolutionary action that demands we show up for people even when it's uncomfortable, even when there's no benefit to ourselves, even when the world tells us they don't deserve it. When COVID-19 hit New York City, a physician quarantined with her sick family. After 5 sleepless nights nursing a feverish toddler, relief came when the fever broke. As new routines settled, an uncomfortable truth emerged. While family was always claimed as the top priority, actually enjoying this time revealed work had been the real priority. Creating a thought experiment where aliens observed daily behavior exposed the painful gap between who we think we are and who we actually are. Research and spiritual wisdom agree, unhappiness stems from this disconnection. This lesson crystallized during a childhood grocery trip that ended after pocketing a Snickers bar at age 12. After paying for it, a mother asked if the meaning of wearing a turban was understood, then shared how Guru Tegh Bahadur's son gave Sikhs their distinctive appearance so they couldn't hide from doing what's right. Your turban is a crown, announcing you'll always do the right thing. The lesson wasn't about shoplifting. It was about integrity, doing what's right whether people are watching or not. Every decision shapes who we become. Our daily actions are seeds growing into habits and ultimately our character. We can't think our way into better character. We must act our way there. When our actions align with our values, we discover a profound wholeness no external achievement can provide. When a daughter asked if caring for her ever felt tiring, the truthful answer came, "Of course not, because I love you." Guru Nanak captured this essence. The giver keeps on giving while the takers get tired of taking. Jaswant Singh Khalra's parable about the lantern challenging darkness reveals the heart of seva, selfless service. The lantern didn't try to end all darkness. It focused on its small corner. Its light inspired others to join, creating collective change. Rather than feeling paralyzed by endless global problems, we focus on what's within reach. By noticing everyday kindness, returning a baby's lost shoe, offering bags when someone's breaks, forgiving a dollar short at the coffee cart, we restore faith in humanity. We don't need to illuminate everything at once. We just need to tend our own corner with fierce love and radical compassion. Each selfless act makes us less selfish and more loving, creating ripples that inspire others. The transformation from experiencing hatred to practicing radical love isn't about perfection. It's about making the daily choice to see divinity in everyone, to practice gratitude even in pain, and to align our actions with our deepest values. Your corner is waiting. What will you illuminate today?